Okay, I believe mine is on also, and okay, we're all set.
All set? Okay. It is June 27th, 2008. We are at 3209 South Cambridge in Lansing, the home of Charles Reesnyder. Also here is John Asif and Craig Gleason. And we're here to get Chief Reesnyder's story. So, Chief, if I may at least start, what drew you to the Lansing Police Department in the very beginning? In other words, why did you want to become an officer with the Lansing Police, or words to that effect?
That's a little story in itself. From the time I was a kid, I don't know why, people told me I should be a policeman. Well, I found out later, I at least figured out later, that most of them were telling me that because it's not the only way I'd stay out of jail. But I never thought of it. I worked, when I came home from the Marine Corps, I worked at Consumers Power Company for a short time, reading gas meters before I started college. And my boss there, wasn't a week go by, he didn't tell me, why don't you go up the street and join the police department? That didn't do it either. A few years later, after I was married, I was working at Fisher Body. My brother-in-law came home from the Army. He'd spent 4 years in the CIA and the Army. And one day he said, I'm going down and put my application in the police department. Why don't you go with me? I said, okay. So I went with him when I got down there, and I figured, well, I might as well make out an application, too, and I made one out. And they did the background investigations and everything, then called the two of us down, Chief Taylor's office. And the first thing Taylor told us is we won't hire two from the same family. So he said, I'm sorry, Wayne, we're hiring Chuck. And why, I don't know, but that's when how I got on the police department.
Wow.
And to go on with that, and started out, asking your notes there about schooling. There was two of us I hired on at the same time, Joe Norton and I. Our schooling consisted of 2 days with Captain Edie in the traffic division, 2 days with Captain Grope in the detective division, and 1 day with Captain Rainwater at Pistol Range. That was our training.
Wow.
And I'll never forget the first night. It was a Monday night, December, I think it was in the first week of December, 1952. And I walked out of that building, 10 o'clock at night. It was about 5 degrees out, and I thought, what the hell am I doing here? And that was the first experience, and went out in the field. I worked in patrol for a year from April 2nd, within what 13 months in patrol. And for some reason, Captain Warner got a hold of me and asked me if I'd like to come over and ride motorcycle. And I'd never ridden a bike in my life, and I said, sounds great to me. I wasn't that happy about walking beats and stuff in patrol. I didn't get along too well with Captain Rainwater, so I did a lot of walking. So I went to traffic and rode motorcycle for 8 years. And to this day, I say it was the best job I ever had. I really enjoyed my time as a motorcycle officer. And with the guys I worked with, we had a great bunch on motorcycles. After 8 years over there, I was promoted to sergeant and transferred back to patrol division. Worked in patrol on Captain Achterhoff's shift. Lieutenant Jackson was, or no, Lieutenant Beach was second in command. And Dick Leeson and I were the two sergeants on the shift. And I worked there on patrol. God, I can't remember how long it was. But that was 1963 that I made sergeant. It was 1968. Six of us were promoted to a new rank of SAS sergeant.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I didn't mention it. I didn't even put it on air. I forgot all about it. At one time, it was a corporal. We had corporal rank at one time. And then, but I made staff sergeant. I was staff sergeant for a while, and then I took a battery of tests along with about 70, 75 guys on the department for Northwestern University Traffic Institute. And I was lucky to be selected and spent a year in Northwestern. My wife and I and our two daughters, who were 4 and 6 months at the time, moved to Chicago and lived in the Rogers Park Hotel, North Chicago. Up on the 9th floor, we had a living room, one bedroom, a kitchen was previously a closet, and they made it into a kitchen when they changed the hotel into rental units. My wife and I slept on the studio couch opens up into a bed. Sure, we slept, and the kids slept in the bedroom. But it worked out fine. Had some great experiences there. Like, there was another guy from Montana who was going there to school with me, and he lived in the same hotel. And we used to go down every morning and wait for the guy from North Carolina. He lived further south, and he'd pick us up in the morning, bring us back at night. Every morning there was this little Jewish man. This was a Jewish neighborhood. And this one little man, he kept an eye on us every morning. And every night when we go home from school, he'd be across the street in front of the drugstore waiting for us. We got dropped off. And he did that for about 2 weeks. And finally, one day he walked up between the two of us. So we were waiting for the traffic light. He says, "Who are you guys?" And we said, "What are you doing here?" Said, "Well, we're going to the Traffic Institute of Northwestern University." "Oh," he says, "you're cops. Thank God, I thought you were mafia."
Okay.
That was living in that Jewish neighborhood was just really something. I thought my baby daughter was very fat. I thought she was going to get cancer in the cheeks. These Jewish ladies kept pinching her cheek all the time. They love kids. And going to the grocery store was a riot watching them. They get in arguments in the grocery store all the time. But we were there for a year. Returned back to work, and I was assigned to Central Records. And because the chief had asked me to direct my attentions, particularly over there on Central Records System. We didn't have a Central Records System in the police department at that time. And so that's why he put me down there to work and try to get that changed around. Tell you what it was like before Central Records. We had a training program at one time with two officers every month to go up and work at the Detective Bureau for a month. It was training. And my partner and I went up there, got up there at a time when it was very slow and not much going on. Broke didn't have any cases to assign us, so he just says, "Well, poke around, see what you can find to do." Well, I had been working a warrant car in the traffic division. Done that a lot. And, when the bikes were laid up, worked the warrant car in the wintertime. So they had all the criminal records up in the Detective Bureau. That's where they were. And we got to looking through them, and I'd pick out warrants, and they were the dead file, they call it. And you'd look on there and say, "This person is deceased." And you look on another one, "This person has moved out of the state," and this type of thing. So a good share of those people, I had just arrested them on traffic warrants. And they'd been in on traffic warrants, and nobody even knew they had criminal warrants out there. The only ones that knew what was in them criminal record files were the detectives. Well, we went out that month, and I can't remember what it was now, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 arrests we made out warrants that said dead or moved out of state and this type of thing. Funny part of it was the captain being happy over that, he was a little upset. he didn't like that too well. But anyway, we eventually got Central Records, got those warrants, criminal warrants downstairs where now it was accessible to all patrol officers and everything else. And, so that was another experience. It was something. But I was down there in Central Records for, I can't remember how long now, but it started giving promotional exams. and took the promotional exam for lieutenant, and I made lieutenant, was sent back up to patrol and run as one of the shifts in patrol. And the one thing that, and I had nothing to do with this, but the guys on our shift really, really got outworked. They were making almost twice the arrests the other shifts were making, doing a heck of a job. They got to the point they knew they were good, and they started calling themselves the super shift. And one day I got a call in Chief Husby's office, and I went down there, and he was, man, what's this super shift thing I'm hearing? I said, yeah, that's what my guys call themselves, the super shift. I thought it was kind of humorous. And he said, I don't want any more of it. He says, the other lieutenants are pretty upset over it. I don't want any more of it. And I said, Chief, I can't tell these guys what they can call themselves, you know. That's their business. And he says, well, you will, by God. Well, I told them to calm it down a little bit, but they never did. They were still the super shift. So the next time, at the end of the month, we used to switch shifts every month.
Mm-hmm.
He had the us lieutenants stay with the same hours for another month, and just the men shift. In other words, he took my shift away from me. Mm-hmm. And the majority of the guys back in those days that were on a shift were not your permanent people. You had your drivers that stayed with you, and the rest of them were the extras. And they kept working around, and it took about 3 months. It wasn't even 3 months. Yeah, it might have been 3 months. And they were all back on my shift again by volunteering to stay over another month on nights and this type of thing. And they were right back to the super shift again, so we always thought that was kind of funny. Pardon me.
I don't know how to put this on hold,
yeah, well,
so I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, hi. I'm pretty good. Oh, good. Hey, let me call you when, after a while. I've got two guys here interviewing me, and I'll give you a call. Oh, okay.
I didn't turn that off.
That's good. That's
my daughter, they're on their way up to the cottage.
Well, where am I? I was in patrol. I was a lieutenant, right?
Yep, you kind of done these three-month shift things, and then they're back to you.
They were back, anyway. And during this period of time, we had captain's exam for rank of captain. And luckily, I came out number one on that. And there's, I think I remember what captain was retired. I think it was Jackson. But anyway, it was Jackson. Some day they were going to make the promotion, the board met and everything else, and everybody knew I was number one on the shift and was congratulating me and everything, and I found out from one of the board members up there that they had promoted Captain Wash. Wash was third on the shift, but I found out later that the information was passed on to the chief that he was number one and I was number three. So they put him down in charge of Central Records, and they sent me down to work for him because I knew Central Records and he didn't. So I was down there for, God, it was only about 3 months, I think. Maybe 3 months. And a Deputy Chief Murphy retired. And there was an opening for Deputy Chief. We took the exams again for Deputy Chief. And one night I got a call to come down to the police board meeting. And I went down there and walked in, and they said, congratulations, you're a Deputy Chief.
So that's from lieutenant? That's right.
I went from lieutenant to
you
Deputy
jumped
Chief.
Jumped captain.
Yeah. And that's the only place I never worked in the department, I guess, was as a captain. But then I went to Deputy Chief. And I was Deputy Chief 6 years. And then they was promoted to assistant chief, I think, for 7 years. And then the mayor went on his nationwide search for a new chief and spent a lot of the city's money. And You guys were there then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
During those times. But a lot of things happened over these years, and I thought I'd just give you a rundown on that. And then,
very good.
The top. I just wrote down some names here to remind me of incidents.
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
You may be interested in. The first one is very, very sad. I don't know if you guys even heard about it. You know, out on Main Street, there's this swamp-like back off in the side out the east end of Maine, and there's a little narrow one-lane road that goes underneath the railroad bridge.
I know the area.
Okay. Yeah,
I think the Border War and Light had that area.
It's one spring that flooded, and it's when I was riding a motorcycle. And somebody called in and said there was a body in the water out there. And I ride motorcycle. It's one thing I liked about the motorcycle, I could get to everything pretty quick. And I got in on a lot of things. That's one I wished I hadn't, because I got there, and a guy got the water and picked up this little boy and brought him to the edge of the water, handed him to me. And I had him in my arms, and Roy Becker, who got the call, was his district, showed up there. And I just handed the boy over to Roy, and he looked at him, and it was his son.
Oh, God.
I don't know if you ever heard about that or
not.
No. Now that you've mentioned it, I had heard a story. You're right. I had totally forgotten about it, but I had heard of. Yes. I didn't hear it like that, but I heard that he went to some call, and it was a drowned boy, and it was his son. I mean, I didn't know you were involved at that particular juncture.
He got him. They had him right out there. He was at the scene.
Wow.
And that was very sad, particularly as Roy and I were very close. I knew how much that boy meant to him. Get on to something that's a little better than that. Kimball, Sergeant Kimball. Was he there when you guys were on?
Nah, I don't recall.
Sergeant Kimball was an old-time type of cop, you know, probably had a eighth-grade education. Great guy, you know, just really a nice guy. And he took care of his people. He was motorcycle sergeant. And one Sunday, I was working, and a lot of times on Sundays they worked, they'd have us go in the traffic office and type accident reports. It's the girls would get behind, be so many of them. And I was the one in there typing accident reports, and he was in there, and the phone rang. And he picked up the phone, and this is the story worked out as I heard about it. It was one of the police commissioners on the phone. He was in a restaurant out on East Michigan Avenue. And he says, I'm in this restaurant out here. And he says, there are three motorcycle police officers in here. He says, that they shouldn't be ganged up like that. And Kimball says, can't be. I only got one signed to that side of town hung up on
it. Oh, hey, yeah. Very good.
That's a... There was a name with Spitzley, Herm Spitzley, sergeants. He was a sergeant over the meter man that walked the beats downtown. And Herm was, he was quite a guy. But for some reason, it was right when I had my first cancer. It was 1957. And I was working, because they wouldn't let me go back on my motorcycle right away, and I was working out on the street out there. And Herm would come down, and he always looked so sad, and like something was wrong, and I couldn't figure out what it is. And he told me, he says, my health, he says, I've got health problems. And I didn't know what the heck it was, but I was still taking my chemo, and I'd get on a bus every afternoon, go to St. Lawrence Hospital, have my chemo. Herm Spitzley's niece was a nurse there. And she says, what are you guys down there doing to my Uncle Herm? I said, what do you mean, what are we doing to him? He says, he's been over here twice in the last 2 weeks to get checked. He thinks he's got cancer. And he hasn't got cancer. There's nothing wrong with him. Well, I come to find out that Bill Ryan was working on him every day, telling him that he didn't look good and he ought to go get checked. And he just had him feeling so bad. And Herm was eating it up and bought every bit of it. To show you what some of the guys did for fun.
There's a few little prankster things that occur.
Uh, Ryan, Bill Ryan, my friend. We went up deer hunting. And one day we went out, and the snow was deep, and I got snow in my boots. And it was before daybreak, and we got out to our spots, and by the time daybreak was breaking, my feet were freezing. Ryan had the key to the cabin, so I knew where he was at, and I went over to, hey, Ryan, get the key. And we lit up a cigarette and was talking, and he was getting the key out of his pocket. We looked up, and there's a deer running across the opening about 100 yards out. And I had a scope on my rifle, so I put it up, and I said, doe. Bill had his rifle up, but he didn't have a scope. And the second one by, I says, doe. And the third one come, I said, bang. That was a buck. And shot it. Well, after we got home, went to work back downtown on the beat on a rainy day, and every store I went in downtown Washington, they'd come to me and say, how come you stole Ryan's deer? He had everybody in downtown Lansing. I stole his deer. That's kind of your good buddies there.
Oh, yeah.
In the police department, especially if you knew Ryan. Got a good one about Zook, Billy Zook. We got a call one time out on Lyons Avenue. People had a deer in the backyard. Railroad tracks run down behind them, and the deer jumped the fence, got in their backyard, and was eating apples. And they had little kids and everything. They wanted that deer out of there. Well, the deer couldn't get enough space to run to jump the fence to get out. And we got there, and Zook got there, and he's standing there, and he says, what are we going to do? He says, oh, I don't know. Well, think about this for a minute. Maybe we can just get him out of this yard, and he'll run down the street and get out some other place. All of a sudden, Zook took off, and he run up, and he tackled the deer. The deer was right up against the fence trying to get up it. He tackled the deer. Thought he was playing football or something. Got the deer on the ground, and he started hollering for a blanket or a gunny sack or something. And the guy who lived there went in the garage, and he came out with a gunny sack, and we put the gunny sack over the deer's head and ripped a hole in it, and then Ryan started asking for sugar. I brought sugar, and he was rubbing sugar on the deer's teeth, and it calmed him right down. Calmed him right down. Hmm. And we got a truck out there, loaded that deer on the back of that truck, and took it out to the campus. Didn't know where else to go, so we went out in one of the college farms and turned that deer loose. And he didn't run 20 yards, and he stopped and turned around and looked at Ryan just much to say thank you.
Turned out left again.
Wow. That's another thing you don't run into every day in Lake.
Absolutely not.
There's another story. Police commissioners. Probably shouldn't tell this one. I used to volunteer to walk North Lansing Beat in the wintertime when the motorcycle was laid up. And I got so I knew everybody up there. And there's a lot of stories come out from that, by the way. One of them was one of the police commissioners who was a real unlikable person. He lived down that area, and every night, 5 o'clock, he'd come down and he'd park in the meter, go in the drugstore and get his paper. He never put any money in a meter. So every day I'd be in the fire station down there waiting for him, and every day he went in, I'd go out and put a parking ticket on his car and go back in the fire station, and he'd come out and he'd see that thing and he'd be mad. And he'd leave. And the firemen got to liking that so well, when I had a day off, they kept a couple of tickets and they put them on there. But we drove him nuts. But that same commissioner, he was one, I remember one time he got on the elevator in a police building, and it was Roy Becker. He reported Roy Becker because he didn't call him sir on that elevator. That's the kind of guy he was. So that's, you know, why we give him parking tickets when we got a chance. It's but I had a thing of when I was walking that beat up North Lansing, I'd only let sergeants especially find me 2 days a week. The rest of the time, it's a big beat, you know, North Lansing. You know how big that was. You walk beats, didn't you?
Yes, sir. I sure did.
So you know how big they were. So, I could stay away from him, and he didn't have anything really to get mad about if he couldn't find me because the meet was so big. And twice a week, people would call me wherever I was at. They'd call me and say, Herm just got off the bus. He got off at Washington and Grand River today, or he got off at Turner, Grand River. And then I'd go out and let him find me. Boy, this is one I really shouldn't tell. Can't even remember what the situation now was, but it was something that was very important. And I had taken the bus down to South Lansing, where Jack Webb was walking the beat. I had something I had to get to him, and I did. Then I got on the bus and went to North Lansing. And how'd that work? No, I got there. Oh, I was on the bus. I wish I remember his last name, the bus driver. Great guy. But Herm was standing on the corner of Shiawassee and Washington waiting for the bus to come to North Lansing. And I'm on the bus.
On your way to your beat.
I'm on the way to my beat. So bus driver, he just waves at Herm, drives right by him. Just puts me off, and the next bus had come, Herm got off the bus, and I was up right close by so he could find me, you know. And he says, let's go get a cup of coffee. I said, okay, we went up to the dime store to get a cup of coffee. He says, I can't figure out what the hell's been. I think his name was Bill. Bill. He says, he went right by me today. He just waved at me. He says, he had another police officer on the bus. I don't know why he didn't stop. But that's just a few stories that I come across.
These are good. Right there. Real good.
Yeah. I was looking in here.
I'm going to change my mind, and I'm going to run another one.
Okay.
Maybe a third one.
While you're looking through there, maybe I can ask you one.
Sure.
During your, we'll say tenure, did you get any, like, on-duty injury type thing? If, say, at a, I don't know, a domestic, a shooting, a stabbing situation, or maybe you got into an injury status?
No.
Good for you.
The only time I ever got hurt on the police department, and it wasn't as I didn't have the opportunity, because I've got in many messes, as you would know. But one time, riding my motorcycle, and it was going down Ionia Street, which is a one-way street, a taxi cab in the right-hand lane, and I was in the left, and got up to the intersection of Washington M, and he turned left right in front of me.
Mm.
And I hit the back end of the back corner of the cab and got a bruise on my leg.
Dumped.
That's the worst injury I ever had on the department. That's right. I've seen a couple of things in here that... But,
while you're looking,
sure. Yeah, we'll keep on talking.
Tell us about some of the arrests that you made. Anything, any big arrests, if not big, memorable in some fashion or another.
Oh yeah. I guess I never look at one arrest as bigger than another arrest, you know. But there's some of them that stand out more. I remember one time that. Some guys broke into a market out at East Kalamazoo. What is that? Can't remember the name of the side street now. It was Ellis Market. And they broke into that, and the state police, that was just outside the city, and the state police came along. They had an old beat-up Cadillac, and they jumped in that thing and took off, and the state police put about 8 bullet holes in the back of that thing, but they got away. And they found the Cadillac a short time later. The two guys were gone, and the description on them was that they looked like they were Indians, which they were. They were that complexion and so on. And my partner and I were on patrol, and we seen this car, and we said, God, that guy looks like an Indian in there. We better stop that and check him out. Well, he didn't have any light on the license plate. A woman was driving, and we stopped, and sure enough, was one of the guys. His name was Ferguson. And the gal, he was taking him around, her husband had been one of his friends in Jackson Prison. Mm. So he knew them, and he went to their house and asked that she take him back to Detroit. And we managed to get him, and he was convicted as a habitual criminal and got life. And I was down to Jackson Prison with a friend of mine at work down there, and we was going through the prison. I'd never been in there, and we'd been in there for quite a while, and got back in the sewing room of all places, and this, there's Ferguson, the big Indian, and he seen me, and he thought I was a relative or a long lost friend. He come running over and hugged me, and oh, it was just unbelievable, really.
Wow. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess he was happy we didn't shoot him on the street. The state police been shooting at him. I don't know.
But what do you recall around the time that you went on the police department? What were the city limits? Obviously, it expanded over the time
God,
that
yes.
you were there. So it was
right.
a much smaller city, so to speak, when you
yeah.
first hired on.
North city limits, pretty much where it's always been. The south city limits was Greenlawn Avenue when I first went on.
Okay.
And then it stretched from there down to Holmes Road. And then eventually all the way down to where it is now. The west city limits. I lived on Barnes Avenue in the 1200 block when I was a kid, grew up there. And Park Avenue was the west city limits. And that's in the south end out there, if you know where Park Avenue's at.
Rough, yeah.
And Barnes Avenue was a dirt road, and Colonial Village was a cornfield. The whole subdivision, everything was a big cornfield. The only residents on Mont Hope, west of Pattengill Street, I say Pattengill because it was the farmhouse that was on Pattengill, but right behind us, right here where I live now, there's a 5-acre field right back here, you know, big white house up on the corner. That was the only house on Mont Hope. This was a chicken farm. I used to ride bike out here to get eggs for my mother. And the grandchildren live in that house today.
Is that right?
Yeah, they still live there. Yeah.
Wow.
But the East City Limits is always, you know, pretty much where it's at, just between East Lansing and Lansing. But it was the south end that we expanded, went south in the past. That's the way I remember it.
Okay.
That's good.
Yeah. How about...
Here's Zook with a deer.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
State Journal was right there, took pictures. That's me. I was the sergeant then, and he was... I'm trying to think who this is. I think it's one of the other officers, and I can't think of his name right now. I will. So, what do you ask?
Well, I was going to say we always seem to ask about big incidents that maybe you were involved in. Natural disaster type things or big riots, anything like that you have a story about.
Okay, let me get this one here first. Okay. There was a situation with this guy. I got his picture in here, his wife's picture. I just seen it a minute ago. He had taken a shovel at his wife, but decapitated her. I mean, that's what he was trying to do. And that was out here in the south end. And I was riding motorcycle back in those days. And I spotted him out on Holmes Road, just this side of Pleasant Grove. And he took off running. There's been a lot of houses. Then he went out into the field, and I took that motorcycle and went out and bounced up and down on that field. But got up on him so quick, he didn't have time to even swing his shovel. I always remember that one because he could have killed her just as well as not. He sure wanted to. I got that in here someplace.
What's that?
God, there's so many of them, you can't hardly think of them. That's why I'm looking at this book, trying to remind myself of some of those things. They're all in here in writing, but I'm... Can't figure out where that one is. But I just seen it. Riots. Yeah, we had many riots.
Yeah.
Most of them out at the campus back in those days. I remember one time particularly, they screaming like hell, they needed help, and we got a big bus, city bus, loaded our guys on it, and I was sergeant then. And we went out to the campus and stopped, and we was just getting ready to get out of the bus, and here come a whole bunch of rioters. They're running down there and throwing bottles through windows and every other damn thing. And I telling the guys, you know, no, let's put a stop to this. And these campus police stopped us. Oh, don't do that. Don't do that. We don't want to cause them, get them mad and cause any more problems. Don't arrest them. So I told the guys, back on the bus. They got back on the bus, and we came back to Lansing. We left them out there with their riot all themselves. We didn't want to take care of it. We didn't have the time to be out there. Martin Luther King riots here in Lansing. I remember each sergeant took a squad of men and went out, and we walked the streets out on the west side of town and basically trying to put people back in their houses. And there was some bottle throwing and that type of thing, but not that much from them. You got more of that from the college kids, the bottle throwing and stuff. Union problem strikes. Motor wheel plant seemed to be great for that up in the north end. And, I remember Simons was my staff sergeant when I was a lieutenant. And we went on the morning shift. They'd been fighting the picketers up there for a week or so, trying to make them behave. And they wouldn't let the salaried employees in. They tried to block the door and all this type of stuff. So Simons and I rode up there the second morning we were on the morning shift. And we sat there watching them. You see what I see? And he says, yeah, they got a couple, three guys in there that are the ringleaders that are causing all the problem. And I says, get our men over here. And he got the men over and we pointed out the three men and said, go in and arrest those three. And arrested those three people. It wasn't half an hour later, got a call to come into the deputy chief's office. And we come in there, and he went up and down me. Why did we make an arrest? Shouldn't have done that. You know, it's their right to strike. And, oh, God, he was going, this is going to cause all kinds of problems. And if you know Murphy, how he was, you know. He just,
oh, yeah.
And he was talking about it. But just as I was getting ready to leave his office, the elevator door opened up, and two men come walking in, and they come down there. And they right into Murphy's office and says, have you got the officers in here that made those arrests out there? And says, yeah, I got them. We're taking care of it. And he says, I want to thank them. He says, by God, things finally calmed down. He says, they should have done that a week ago. Murphy says, oh, yeah, we thought it'd be a good idea. that's the way it went. I can't find what I'm looking for. Feel free to look through that if you want. No, this is nothing in here. This is just all about, I don't think, I think most of it's about when I got promoted. Your editorial letters and stuff, yeah. I still don't see these little stories we're going along. If you can think of any other types of incidences that I might be able to respond to, I'd be glad to.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the changes that occurred in the police department as far as like, did you have any role in increasing the training for the officers? I know when I started in 73, there was a lot of training.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot to start out with in the academy, and then there was continuing training.
Yeah. Well, I was, of course, involved in teaching classes to the guys, but I think I had some input in increasing the training and the type of training, but a lot of the guys did that ended up being later on being the command officers around the department. We all knew that we had to have more training than we were having, and then, of course, then the state passed the training law where you had to go to the academy. Before the academy, we did it all in house. Now there's one I had a real tough assignment. That's when I was laid up and had to walk a beat downtown, and they had a donkey down there. They tied the donkey to the fire hydrant. So the State Journal thought it'd be a good idea if they got a picture of me putting a parking ticket on the donkey.
Wow, let's see. 1956.
Yeah.
That's good. You got all these articles and so on.
Oh, yeah. This one's was escorting a bunch of the colleagues down to the Capitol building for something. Oh, there's a lot of stories in here. If this time go through all of them, but I didn't even find this book until this morning. I didn't know where my wife had put it. Oh, here's the guy. Hit his wife with a spade. Right here.
Oh, yeah. You got the shovel or spade right there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, let me ask about a couple other major incidents that a lot of times get mentioned. I'm going to say both of them, and you can talk about any or both of them or none of them, but the Mag Donnelly incident and the
Lori Murnihan.
Did you play a role in any of those, in either of those two events?
No, I was working when Donnelly got shot, but I wasn't involved in it too much. The Murnihan thing, I was a little more involved, not by department assignment, but by the fact that I knew the Murnihams very well, and I wanted to do something, so I spent a lot of time trying to run down the little weeds that I was getting every month. Thing, but we did know who did it, and he went to Jackson on another charge. We never could prove what he did. And then he was murdered in Jackson prison. The guy that killed him. And tell you a story about me, but it involved Murnihan. Murnihan was mayor. That was when I was going to Northwestern. And they called and said the mayor's coming over there for meetings at Northwestern. And one of the police commissioners was coming with him. I wanted to know if I'd pick him up at the airport. O'Hare Airport. I said, sure. They told me the time and the flight number and all that stuff. I never had been out to O'Hare Airport. So I go out there and I'm driving along and there's a line of traffic. You know, just a line of traffic. It's all going to O'Hare Airport. So I get in the line and right along, get up and go into a gate. Security guard out there just waved at me and I went on in. Cars were pulling this way and pulling that way and parking and this type of thing. And I went down and made a turn. And I stopped and I said, what the hell? I was right out next to a runway. Security guard thought I was one of the workers. I didn't know where the hell I was. I was a damn plane took off right in front of me. If I hadn't stopped, I'd have been in trouble. Finally got around and got the mayor, Max, and we got back out of the area there, and every street out there is just a line of traffic, you know. And we're going down this street very slow, you know, bumper to bumper. And we come to this one corner, and Max says, you know, I've been over here. I think you should turn right here. And I turned there this morning. I'm not turning there again. He wanted me to go down the same route I'd already went. Got on the... Yeah, it's...
Hair is huge.
This one, man dies in plunge. A guy named John Yerk, Y-E-R-K-E. I watched this, seen it happen. I had just come out of the City Hall door on Capitol Avenue, walked out and looked down, and I seen this body coming down. The guy jumped off the building, and then went 200 block. And so I ran up there and tried to help him, but it was too late. He was a goner already. But you talk about feeling helpless.
Wow, yeah.
When you see a guy do that. And James Sears. Over.
Well, there's a thing called parity pay that kind of came up in the mid to late 60s, some time frame in there. Did you, what's your recollection of that, if you wish to comment on those?
It was just that the fire department has always made less money than the police department, and they decided they should get the same pay we got. And they started quite a campaign around town and everything else, and finally got it on a ballot to get equal pay with the police department, and they lost. That's about all it was to it. We were very, very close, police and fire department. We all belonged to the Metropolitan Club, went to dances together and had all kinds of different things that we did. The ball games, we'd see each other after that parody vote. They got mad at us. We don't have nothing to do with the police department anymore. So for a long time, then we had to watch it when we went out and get our motorcycles down in the basement. I wasn't riding then, but the guys that were had to watch it. And I can tell you about another thing about when I hired on. When I spent the 2 days with Groke, he took us down to the number one fire station, Norton and I. And says, the fireman, we're going to have a cup of coffee. So we went in, went back in their cafeteria, and was sitting there talking to a few of the firemen, having a cup of coffee. And Charlie Decker was the fire chief then. Charlie Decker grew up, or lived on Mortimer Drive. And I grew up with all of his kids, Tommy and Pete, who later on were both. One of them was chief, and the other one was deputy chief. Good guys. But anyway, we're sitting there, and Chief Decker comes in, and he looks at me, and he says, Chuck, John, he says, what are you doing in here? Did you join the police or the fire department? He says, no, just joined the police department. Police department? I got every kid in the neighborhood on the fire department. How come you're on the police department? I says, well, I'm the only one in the neighborhood had any ambition. I wanted to work, and he kicked me out of the fire station. Take me out of the fire station. Groke right along with me.
Oh, my.
Yeah, we had some times. We got all these different, if you guys want these things on promotions and who got promoted when, papers, articles are right here. Like the first six that ever made staff sergeant. I just passed that one in here. You might want to ask some of the to interview any of these guys. Well, I just seen it, man.
I thought I saw it, too, because I remembered some of those.
Yeah, it was.
It was roughly in 67 or 68 time frame.
Oh, it's right here. Someplace. Right here. No, that's not it. This is one made what here?
Can I ask you a question about the FOP? Now, I'm trying to think of your... I think... Were you ever a member of the FOP?
No. I can't remember what rank I was then, but when it started out, it was patrolmen and corporals, and I think sergeants, and it went in FOP.
When you were chief, did you have any run-ins with the FOP?
Well, before I was chief, I wouldn't say run-ins, but 7 years that I was assistant chief, I did all the negotiating for the department. I was probably the first police officer and command officer in the state of Michigan that did union negotiations. Mm-hmm. I went to a number of schools getting an education in that area, and we got along fairly well. We had time, so it would take us a long time to settle an issue, but we'd usually come up with something that was fair and equitable. You had a couple guys that represented the FOP that wanted to be hard-nosed sometimes, but they got over it.
Well, I always kind of thought it was curious that that the city would negotiate with the police union and there was nobody there from the police department, administrator from the police department. I found that really curious when I first started doing that.
All right. Well,
and apparently they finally wired up and put you there.
I was there for 7 years doing
but
that.
But it was hard to deal with those people because they didn't understand what we did.
Oh, yeah.
And
well, I still had, when I was doing it, so of course I had somebody from personnel office and somebody, Jan Lazaro, I insist she's in on everything, you know, so she'd come and sit in on it. And usually I had more trouble with her than I had with the FOP. And
she can stir the pot.
Yeah. She caused more problems in that city than anybody will ever know. She caused McCain, and what's his name, that councilman, their pensions.
Blair.
she convinced them that they were eligible for that early out pension, and they both took it, and after they were out there for a while, they had to give the money back. And but she wanted it. She set the whole thing up so she could get it, and she convinced them. That's why they went along with it. And, oh, she
That's
was
interesting.
Yeah, she was a piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
She really was. Stan Burnett, by the way, is he comes to our meeting once a month, but he is getting Alzheimer's.
Yeah, we sat down with him. I don't remember, maybe in February, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And we could tell his memory had somewhat diminished, and we knew it was a dementia situation.
Yeah.
But we weren't sure how.
When we met last Wednesday, we were all talking, and it was breaking up. Just he and I were talking. What were we talking about? The situation we were talking about. He told me the same thing in the same exact words three times within 10 minutes.
Mm. Classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My father has Alzheimer's. And
my mother had Alzheimer's.
He's 91, and he's. But yeah. I'm around it enough to kind of get a pretty good handle on.
Kavanaugh, probably another reason I got into the police department, because I had talked to him before I went down there with my brother-in-law and put the application in. Seen him, he was walking a beat downtown one day, and I was downtown, and we went to have a cup of coffee. And he says, "Damn, Charlie, this is a good job. You want to join the police department?" You know, and he talked like crazy to me about joining the police department. And then after I joined, he was only there a month or two, and he smacked some guy he shouldn't have smacked, and he got disciplined, and he made him mad, and he quit. And he was off the department for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, 4 months maybe, and they let him back on, which I was glad they did, because he was a good cop.
So while he was off, was that like a suspension-type situation, or had he resigned, or what was that?
Yeah, he lost his seniority that he had and everything. He quit.
Oh, he actually did quit.
Yeah.
Okay. But then they let him back in. Okay. I'd never heard about that situation.
Yeah.
So that was, that must have been, in the 50s anyway, early on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Because I went to the department December of 52. It was in 53 when he quit.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other types of situations I should be thinking about here?
Well, let me ask you.
You're doing very well.
As chief, and we can only imagine what it must have been like, but how was it to deal with the city side as being a department head and having to deal with the politics and
okay.
Kinds of things that went on in the city? I mean, you alluded to a little bit of it when you referred to the old budget lady.
Mm-hmm.
But there must have been other kinds of things.
I really got a good foundation for it, because when I was deputy chief, Busby was chief. No, he was O'Toole was chief.
Mm-hmm.
And before the charter was changed, we always had to have a department head at the council meetings. Well, O'Toole never wanted to go, so he'd send me. And I went to council meetings every week for a couple of years. I learned, just by sitting there and listening, I learned how to deal with politicians.
Mm.
And one of the first instances, well, not one of the first, but one of the instances to show you is dealing with politicians. After McCain had his press conference and everything up his office, I'm pointing at me, chief. The next day, I was sitting in the office, just moved into the chief's office and sitting there, and the city attorney comes in. He took some papers down in front of me, and I said, "What's that?" And he says, "It's your contract. Sign it." And I said, "Well, sit down. I don't sign anything until I read it." And I read it over, and I got done. I threw it back to him. I said, "I won't sign that." He says, "Why?" I says, "Why, you're the city attorney, and you don't know why I won't sign anything? It violates the city charter in two places, and I won't sign it." He said, "If you don't sign it, you can't be chief." I said, "Okay, you go right back up and tell the mayor to have another press conference tomorrow and unappoint me, because I won't sign that contract." And the next day, the mayor comes down, and he's got that contract. He says, "What is it in here you don't like?" So I took it, and I took a red pencil, underlined everything I didn't like in it, and told him why I didn't like it, and gave it back to him. He sat right there and wrote in, changed the wording on everything, and gave it back to me. He says, "How's that?" I read it over. He says, "Okay, that's fine. You get that typed up, and I'll sign that." I never, ever had any problem with McCain after that. He let me run the department. He didn't stick his nose in it like this guy we got now, or like Hollister. Hollister ruined the department. And McCain never. He asked me. He was asking me things I'd do with other departments. And I had another instance while I was the acting chief, while they were going through their nationwide search. It was budget time. And I was up to the council budget committee hearings. And they sat there with my proposed budget that I gave them, and they, "Oh, we don't want that in here." And, "Yeah, I agree with you. We don't want that." And they were crossing things out. I said, "Get together on something else." "No, that's too much money. We won't do that." And this went on for a while. They crossed quite a few main things that we needed, you know. And they were crossing them out. And there was other people, you know. You'd be surprised. Other people just come in and sit and listen to council meetings. They have no business there, but they're there. And there was a reporter from the Journal was in there. So I asked him, I said, "Can we take a recess? Can I meet with the three of you in one of the offices for a minute?" And they said, "Yeah." So they called me, and we went in the office. I says, "Okay, I just want to tell you what I'm going to say in front of that reporter in there when we go back in the room." "What's that?" "I'm going to say, I don't know why the hell you pay all of us department heads the money that you pay us when you think you're going to run the departments. What do you pay us for? You're telling me what department you're, none of you know police work, and you're trying to tell me what we need and what we don't need." I said, "That's all I got to say." And I get up and I started to walk out, and they grabbed me physically and pulled me back in the room. I said, "God." And they said, "Oh, that's the way I want to do it. You know, that's what we're trying to do. We just thought we were going to suggest." And all this, I said, "No, you wasn't." We talked for a little bit, went back in that room, and they passed my budget exactly like I submitted it. Give me everything I wanted.
Wow. That brings up another thought. How about how about your relationship with the sheriff, where that may have been while you were chief? Or didn't you have much to do with him?
Oh, yeah. No, with the Predmore was, that while I was chief. Predmore was there for a long time before that, and I always got along with Predmore all right. He was another one. He's a politician, so you had to handle him like a politician. Mm. You couldn't handle him like a police officer. You couldn't handle him like a politician. And all the sheriffs are that way. When he got out there now, you know, he used to be on our Metro Narcotics squad.
Yeah, he's a lieutenant with MSP, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and they were a sergeant, I think it was. Maybe,
okay.
Maybe he's a lieutenant.
Yeah,
I take that back. I don't know for sure, but I thought he was a sergeant. And but anyway, he never missed a press conference whenever they made an arrest and all this stuff. There was two squads. The other squad could be out making an arrest and doing the work, but when they had the press conference, he was there, and it was his name, and ended up in the paper. He worked that job. He got a lot of publicity, and he's pretty well known, and he runs for sheriff, and that's how he got the job. And that's in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I had an instance there where I got it around here someplace, a copy of the letter. Jerry Mills was running against him, first time he run.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Oh, yeah. I worked on the campaign.
Yeah, and they, how the hell did that go? The State Journal was just bad-mouthing the hell out of Mills. And who else was it? They were just giving him bad press. They didn't give good press to, I can't think of his name now.
Wigglesworth?
Wigglesworth. You would give really good press to him. And then this character is a commissioner, a county commissioner from the campus out there. Been
Grubner,
over here.
Mark Grubner.
Mark Grubner. He was the one that really, he really sent some stuff into the Journal. Bad mouth of bones. He's just anti-police. And I wish I had the letters available you could read it, because I wrote him a scathing letter. I mean, I really told that son of a bitch off. And we should be talking that way if you got that camera. But anyway, he ended up going to consul. He wanted my job. I got it and all that stuff about him. And I just told constantly, you know, I only wrote what's true. If you don't believe me, just read what he wrote, you know. And they supported me and pretty much told him, you know, he shouldn't write things that he don't know. It's just going to stand behind. But he didn't like me, you know, probably still don't. But there again, it's politicians. And you got it. If people would just stand up, politicians, we wouldn't have half the trouble with them we have. But everybody seems to be like it's illegal to stand up to a politician. You know, like everything they say is supposed to be gospel. The minute they get elected, they think they're an authority in everything, and they're an authority in nothing, usually. So that I always base my actions on.
Well, it sounds to me, it's what you described earlier, your school for that was when you attended those council meetings as a representative for the chief back whenever, say in the early 70s or mid-70s thereabouts, I guess.
Right, I learned an awful lot there.
Yeah,
and
that was very wise in a sense. I mean, maybe you were directed to do so, but you took that assignment and...
Yeah. Hey, you're only there in case they had a question to ask you about something your department was involved in. That's all you were there for. So I took the time. As long as I'm here, I might as well
learn.
You know, and
yeah,
I did. Oh, you asked about schooling too, and your thing. I looked for. I got one packet down here with the certificates from all those different schools I've been to, but the main ones. Again, I wasn't thrilled. When I was a kid, my whole life was sports. I played basketball, football, and baseball. And that's all I cared about. That's what I did in the Marine Corps. I played the sports teams and traveled all over the country playing against colleges and stuff when I was actually high school age.
Wow.
Because I quit high school and went to the Marine Corps. But I got my high school diploma, and I started down in Western Michigan. I was there for 1 year, almost a year. And I come home one weekend, and my dad said, Luke Appling wants you to call him. Luke Hamlin. Luke Appling. That's how you pronounce his name. He was a pitcher with the Detroit Tigers and the Brooklyn Dodgers, and it was from Lansing. And so I called his number, and he asked if I could come out to his house and see him. And he was manager of the Leesburg, Florida team, minor league ball. And before I left his house, I signed a contract.
Wow.
Then I quit college. I couldn't play ball in college. There was no sense going to college, right? Mm-hmm. So I quit college. And before, I had my bags packed in March, ready to go down to Leesburg. And I got a telegram from him that they'd sold the club and he lost his job as manager. He says, but I got your contract. He says, I'm now with the Saginaw Bears, the Class A Central League, as a player coach. And he says, I've talked to the manager about you. He wants to see us. So he says, we're breaking camp in Tennessee. We start the season next Monday. He says, if you can get up there sometime in the next 2 weeks, be prepared to work out with us. And the manager wants to evaluate it. So I went up, and I got up there, and I never seen Luke Hamlin in the 3 days I was there. He pitched the day before I got there. And they said every time he pitched, he'd go off on a three-day drunk. And I got a little bit discouraged with that, and I was staying in the same hotel with the Flint team, which was a Detroit farm club. And that's when got Jimmy or Billy Pierce and Houdeman, and half the guys that ended up playing with the Tigers were on that team at that time. And I'd sit, talk to them in the lobby. And let me tell you, back in those days, minor league baseball life was not good, you know. You traveled old rickety old buses. You had to pay your own expenses when you were at home. They only paid them when you're on the road. And there wasn't that much money involved. I said, to hell with it. I come back home, end up getting married. Went to work at Fisher Body. And then when I got on the police department, shortly after I got on at community college, started their first law enforcement courses. I think, if I remember right now, it was a 27-credit program, and a bunch of us from the department went down and took that. And then I ended up going back, and as a and I had got an associate's degree at Community College in business management. And then I won the scholarship to Northwestern, and I got 2 years of college credits at Northwestern. That was an intensive program. It was one college year, but they give you 2 years of college in that 1 year. We were in a classroom from 8 to 4 every day. You don't get that in college, but we did there. So we got a lot of credits from that. And then I went to the BI Academy and got 20 credits from the University of Virginia from there. And I think I ended up with 7 colleges that I got credits from. I took courses at Michigan State. I took courses at the University of Michigan. And I finally, to put it all together and get a degree, I went to Northwood University. And I got a degree in business administration. But I was a long time getting my college degree because I was so wrapped up in sports when I was young and should have been studying.
Kind of shook out. Worked out okay.
Well, you worked out fine. Yeah, it did. I know you asked about education, so I better run that down for you.
No, you did. Yeah, excellent. Excellent job there. Yes.
How about your family? One of the things that's kind of on this list here, your family, before you went into the police department, what did they think about you becoming an officer? Were they supportive, or did they think it was...
Really, I never asked them. At least on my wife's side, I didn't. My dad, of course, he was hurting real bad. His whole life, all he ever wanted me to be was a professional baseball player. My dad had an eighth grade education. He quit school in the eighth grade and lied his age, he and his brother. He was 15, his brother was 16. They took papers home to their mother who couldn't read English and said, sign these when you work on a farm this summer. She signed them. The farm they worked on was in France. They went in the army. And my dad was wounded when he was 16 over there. And then he come back and met my mother, and she also quit school to the 8th grade. So neither one of them had any advanced education. And it wasn't, that they knew that much. My dad always wanted me to have an education for my mother, but they didn't really know how to go about it and push me and that type of stuff. So I had the greatest dad in the world. And mother.
There was an incident of shooting at a grocery store where
on Michigan Avenue.
Yelk got shot in the eye.
Bielan got shot, Yelk got shot, and one other one. That was before I went on department.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah, it was just before I went on the department.
Did that kind of give you a little bit of a pause?
No.
With regard to your decision making?
No. I was always mad my whole growing up years that I wasn't old enough to be over fighting for my country. And it wasn't until right at the end of the war that I became old enough. And I joined the service 3 times, like my dad did, but they caught me every time and sent me home. And when I finally got old enough, I quit school and went to the Marine Corps. And I was always mad I missed that fighting, and I guess I welcomed it. We thought a lot different back in those days. Patriotism, all that type of thing.
Do we have anything more on our list here?
There's just one in the area of technology. From, we'll say, the time that you started, and you obviously saw various changes in technology, can you comment on that? One maybe particular area, whether it's in, I don't know, the cars, communications, or something of this nature, what was probably the most important that impacted, we'll say, yourself as well as law enforcement as you saw it at that point?
Let me go back from when I first went on and kind of work forward as what I seen.
In technology?
In technology and happened.
That worked, yeah.
I don't know, what years did you guys come out of the department?
Me, 66.
In 73.
Okay. I'm back in the 50s. In the 50s, we walked 5-6 beats every night, all night long. The only communication that beat officer had out there was a call box. If it was a big beat, there's a call box on each end. If it was a smaller beat, there was one call box. You had to call in every hour. And That was your only communications. If you arrested somebody, you had to walk them to the call box to call for a car to come pick them up and take them in the station. Talk about call box, it just brings to mind. That was kind of dangerous sometimes because it was not unusual to open up the call box. If you wasn't looking, you'd reach in and grab a rat by the neck rather than the phone.
Yes.
They had to watch all the time. And it wasn't until, God, I can't even remember what year it was, we finally got walkie-talkies. That was a big, big advancement in our communications. It was the walkie-talkie. And we thought we were really progressive when we got those. We had radios. They weren't the best thing in the world in the cars and on the motorcycles, but we had them. And we could get our calls and report back. Then we went along, God, I can't think, do it, put it to years. There wasn't a heck of a lot of advancement after that for quite a while, regarding technology. We got, the next thing is, computers, and that didn't happen until well into the 70s.
Well, probably 911. Did you have anything to part in the 911 system?
I had a lot to do with that. I had, what rank was I then? I was deputy chief then. I was sent out to a meeting of the Tri-County Council of Governments or something was the name of it. I think they still have it. I don't know. It was members of each political jurisdiction in the Tri-County area that met. And they had me go out there, and they had heard about 911, and they thought that we should be looking into it. And they gave me the assignment to contact all the jurisdictions, see if they would like to get into something like this, and to basically set it up. Hardest job I ever had. Politicians, the smaller jurisdiction they're from, the least amount of authority you have, the harder they are to deal with. They don't want to give up anything. But the hardest ones to deal with when it come to 911 was East Lansing and Meridian Township and the campus. They want nothing to do with it. And we started out trying to set it up Tri-County wide. I knew every politician in the Tri-County area because I met with every one of them. And most of them, they were for it. But those that I mentioned were not. We decided, well, we're not going to get this done Tri-County-wise. And we decided, well, let's try to set it up for the 9 townships, Lansing and the townships around it. And to get that going, we wrote a federal grant, request for a federal grant for the money to do it. And to get that federal grant, we had to have everybody in the area we're talking about had to be part of it. If one unit said no, we wouldn't get the federal grant. The guy that was the head of East Lansing City Government, great guy. Can't think of his name right now, but I will. But anyway, he was all for it. But he retired. He'd been out there running East Lansing for years, and he retired. He got the new guy in there, and they wanted nothing to do with it. But I talked him into just going along with it for a year. And the campus and Meridian Township, if you just come in for a year, so we get the grant, we get it set up, then if you want out, you can get out. And they finally agreed to do that. And we got the federal grant and got it going, and a year later, they dropped out. East Lansing, I think, went for another 3 years after that before they got 911 out there of their own. And they had their own 911 system. But great thing, and it's a lot better today than it was then, of course. One of the other technologies that come along, I can't tell the years and stuff, was the NCIS, the National Crime Information Service. That was good because you could contact them and get information on people from all over the country. We didn't have that when I started. I had nothing.
The LEM system. And I don't just mean the computer thing, but that was a whole system of tracking everything through the department. Did you have anything much to do with that?
No, I didn't. Well, the computers. Yeah, I was. That's when I was charged with Central Records, and was trying to set up the Central Records. All of a sudden, we got into talking to the computers, getting computers. I don't know if you guys remember the first computers we had. The two of them were about almost as big as this room.
Right.
God, they were huge.
Yeah.
They were huge. Big, big old things. Yeah. And that's a great advancement, of course. And we got the computers for our communications. We used to be, I think we were gone from there by the time you guys come on. Our communications dispatch was down on the first floor in the traffic office.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have one, maybe two dispatchers in there. And they did a good job, but by God, they had their hands full, too.
That brings up something. I worked the jail, so did Craig, for quite a lot. Did you have anything to do with the jail, for the most part, during your career? Did you ever work there?
Yeah, when I was in patrol, we run the jail. The shifts run the jail. And, we had a lot to do with that.
You remember any jail stories in particular?
I could if I started to think about it, but it might take more time than you got for me to come up with them. There's a lot of stories with the jail. Some of the things that happened back in the jail between prisoners were, as you might imagine, you know, sexual nature and things like that.
Well, one other thing, and we're getting kind of, we're probably close to or at or hour and a half, but the White Spot Grill on West Side. Now, that was a stop for a lot of police officers. You spend any time at the White Spot Grill?
Sure. Sure. Everybody did. Yes, sir. That's where we used to get our prisoners' food from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they trucked it into us every mealtime. Food come from the White Spot Grill. And I started hanging out in there when I was working at Fisher Body. You know, one of my first attempts at doing some police work. I was walking home. I used to walk from Fisher Body to Ray Street and My Hope. You know where that's at?
Yes.
We lived over there. That's how I used to walk home.
Wow.
And I got out of work at 1:30 in the morning, and I was walking home. I was going down Logan Street. Right there by Williams, there's two officers, and they're having a hell of a time arresting a guy, getting him in the car. And it was Art Hibbert and Felix Zook. And I went up and I asked them if they needed any help. I was going to help put that guy in the car. And they said, no, we think we can get it. So I said, well, I'll stick around in case you need help. And I just stood off the side of it. Never forget that. They got that guy down on the ground and tussled with him, and they twisted his leg and broke his leg.
Mm.
Never forget that. Put him in the car. And I was like, man, oh man, I thought, kind of stuff. Felix Zook gave me a traffic ticket once when I was working at Fisher Body. Going to work, and I was a little late, and he got me for speeding. He gave me a traffic ticket. You're doing a good job, but I don't appreciate you. I didn't like his attitude. Felix was quite a guy, though. Good guy. His kid was a good officer. You realize how many of the guys that I went through that department with, their kids are retiring.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
I can't believe that. Who's the one I heard of just the other day is retiring now?
Bayless?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I called him.
Yeah?
Congratulations. I love that kid. I never could figure out how come he was Jack's boy and not mine, because he's such a nice kid, I wanted him. And I never had a son.
He had to get most of his genes from his mother,
yes.
All I could think
That's
of.
That's what I always said. That's what I've always said. Yeah, Jack, he's something again. He was a good cop, though. He really was.
Yeah.
He could do a good job. But he's crazy. He's just full of it. He's full of it. I said we could talk for 2 weeks talking about the individuals, because there's so many stories and so many top guys. I wish
I thought of more stuff than I have to give you.
No, you've done excellent.
Yes, absolutely excellent.
Really?
Top flight.
That's why I got this out. I just go through it and it reminds me of things, you know.
Well, that's great. Let's just wrap this up right now.
Sure.
And, of course, I want to thank you very much for this interview. It is, has been excellent.
And, oh, it's a stop. There's one thing we should talk about.
All right.
Your snowstorm. Of, I think it was 1967. The big snowstorm, 27 inches. I was working the morning shift, and I'm sleeping away, having a good time. My wife got up to feed the baby, and she's seen all that damn snow, and she calls the department and says, "Aren't you calling them in early? Don't you want Chuck in there?" Yeah. They said yes, and but how in the hell am I going to get there? You know. Well, they said the closest they could get to me. I lived in Hollyway, way down at the east end of it where it curves. The closest they could get to me was Hollyway and Pleasant Grove. So I got all dressed and my deer hunting coat on and everything else for warmth, and I walked right into cars going down in the snow. It was so deep, and drifted and stuff. I got down and they had a 6x Army truck. They'd went and borrowed 6x Army trucks from Diamond Rail, and that's what they patrolled in for, oh God, I think, the better part of a week, maybe longer. And somebody had donated the use of a Jeep to the department. You know, there wasn't many four-wheel drive vehicles around back then. Certainly we didn't have any on the department. So I got the assignment with the Jeep, and my job was to pick up doctors and nurses and get them to the hospital and take them home. And when I wasn't doing that, I'd stop and help shovel people out of their house so people could get food into them and stuff. But I tell you, there was a lot of hard work put in by a lot of people, police officers, during that storm. And guys, situations like that, the guys always make you proud.
Yep, you mentioned you got into whatever gear you could just to stay warm, because that's the, I recall that too, and they said just so your badge is on the outside and you can get to your guns. Yep. You know, you don't have to wear a uniform to work this time. That we thought that was cool.
Well, I put my uniform on after I got down because I didn't want to wear that big old deer hunting coat and stuff, but we had them old, remember them old wool overcoats we used to have?
Yep, old horse blanket.
Yeah, damn, things were heavier as hell. I think it was the only time I ever wore one during that snowstorm. Floods. The floods in 47, I think it was. Not 47. I'm thinking the floods of
about,
the east side all floods.
74.
That might have been it. I knew there was a 4 in it.
About 74, 75.
I never got so mad in my life. We were over there working on trucks, going down and picking up stuff after the water went down and cleaning the neighborhoods up, you know. I don't care, you guys did that, but a bunch of us did. And them damn characters that lived down there sat on their front porch drinking beer and, yeah, look at you poor guys have to go out there and we're picking their crap up, you know.
I remember having to, we'll say, escort some of the city building inspectors looking at the foundations of houses. And we were walking around and we're in like knee waders or whatever the fire department loaned us, you know, big boots. And I don't remember the name of the, I want to say it was a Taikaki, not Jim, but the older brother that worked, I think, in the building department. And we thought we almost, we lost, all of a sudden his feet went under, he went in the water. I mean, because we didn't realize that the foundation of the house had caved in underneath it and so on. And he went, and he was like sucked right in, and we were just struggling just to pull him up. But yeah, I remember that flood.
No, see, now I'm sitting here, I think of other things, like the old police building, which you guys would know nothing about.
No, I didn't know.
It was, City Hall was on Ottawa Street. Later became City Hall Annex. Previous to that was the post office. It was right there at the corner of Michigan and Capitol. And we used, the police department had some offices on the one side of the first floor. That was the police department. Our locker room was down in the basement. It was rat infested. We did have a pool table down there, so we had pool cues to hit the rats with when they got around. And so that was quite an advancement when we got the new building. That was really something. Yeah, I can remember one time, I can tell this story about Rainwater now because he's gone. In the old building, he used to call every night, have one of the cars working in the proper district up in the north end to go pick up a pie for him. Always wanted to stamp homemade pies this out, but just, they like homemade pies. Yeah, they called us one night and we got it, and they kind of ticked me off, you know, I'm a police officer, now you're running out delivering pies. So the next night they called again to pick up a pie for him. So we got the pie and we come back and there was, we entered in the back, the booking desk was in the back of City Hall, and it was about four steps, cement porch there, four steps that went up. And he come to that door and was waiting for me to bring that pie up. Well, I tripped on the second step and dropped that pie upside down all over that deck. That's why Rainwater and I didn't go on so well. But then I never got sent after a pie after that. That was the last time I had to go get a pie. Rainwater was a piece of work. Where I got in bad with him, I knew him when I was a kid. I didn't know him, but I knew who he was. He lived in our neighborhood. And I seen him one time coming to Probst Drugstore with his wife, and I thought it was his daughter, but it wasn't. He never had a daughter. But a little girl, and they set up the counter, and the clerk asked him what they wanted, and his wife says, well, we haven't made up our mind yet. And he grabbed them both by the arm and said, if you don't know what you want, you don't need anything, and dragged them out the front door. And I thought, man, there's the meanest son of a bitch I ever seen. Then I get on the police department, and I go out to the pistol range, not the first time, but yearly training later, and there's about 20 of us out there. And it's raining, we're sitting in that building, and he's talking, and he's got everybody, and in fact, guys had told me he was a Marine. He wasn't a Marine. He was raised on a Marine base. His dad was a Marine, but he had everybody thinking, well, I was a Marine, I didn't appreciate that, so I let him know it. So he didn't like me for that either. But there was some great, oh, I'll tell you one about Chief Taylor. God, I should never forget this. When he talked to us, my brother-in-law and I, when he says, if you got on the police department, what would be your goal? I said, sit in your chair. If I get in the police department, I want to be the chief someday. That's good, you know, went on and on. That first day that I sat in that chair, this chief, I got a phone call. And his voice is so distinctive, you knew right off, it was, Charlie! I said, hi, chief, how you doing? He said, Charlie, you remember what you told me when I hired you? He says, no, I don't. What's that? He says, you told me you wanted my goddamn job. He says, well, you got it.
I'll be darned.
He was quite a guy. Yeah. I tell a lot of stories about Charlie Strager. One time I was riding a motorcycle, and the guy used to own a Swanee Drive-In at the South End. His boy was playing baseball for Everett. And they had a game, practice over in, they didn't have a field then, they were over on Sycamore. And I rode up on a motorcycle, was watching them, and I thought, my God, those kids are never going to be able to hit the ball the way they're swinging a bat and everything, you know. So I got a hold of this kid, and I told him, I says, hey, a couple, three of your buddies, I pointed them out, I says, you guys don't know how to hit. Stick around, I'm going to give you some batting lessons. So they did. I hung my helmet on my motorcycle, and I went out there, and I was playing ball with these kids, trying to teach them how to bat. Probably an hour and a half. When I got back on my bike, I got a signal too. So let's go into the chief's office. I don't know if you had that when you were out there or not. We still had that. Mm-hmm. So I go in. When I got off the elevator, Charlie Strager standing in his doorway. He says, God damn it, get in here. Madder now. Trying to act mad anyway. And I went in there and he says, where in the hell have you been for the last hour and a half? I said, down to Sycamore Ballpark, chief. What are you doing down there? I says, well, these kids playing ball and they didn't know how to swing a damn bat and I was trying to teach them. He says, did they learn anything? And I says, I think so. He says, good, that's good public relations.
Good deal.
You can go.
That's all there was.
George Warner, same way. Riding motorcycle and I stopped this kid. He was a grad student out of Michigan State. And he was a nasty son of a bitch. And he was just giving me all kinds of lip. I was writing him a ticket. And I finally called him a bastard or something. I think it was a bastard. I said, you bastard, you better get in the car before I'll arrest you.
Well, an hour later, I get a call to go in George Warner's office. And that's when the captain's office was right at the front of the first floor. And you used to go down, go in the traffic office, and walk a hallway back down. When I went in there, he's standing in the doorway. Get down here. Okay. Walk down there, walk in his office, and here sits this guy. And he says, Officer Ray Snyder, he says, this gentleman tells me you called him a bastard. Did you? And I said, yes, sir. Why'd you call him a bastard? Because he was acting like one. He says, okay, go back to work. You're fine.
Well, they're looking for his honesty.
That's all. I always told him the truth.
Yeah.
And I tried to do the same way when I was up there. When anybody talked to me, they told me the truth. I don't care what they did. They told me the truth. We worked it out.
Good deal. Very good. I like a lot of these. So, okay. So we're going to conclude, and it's just shortly after 12 noon. Thank you.
Very good. Yes, indeed.